Hi there. It's time now for your friendly neighborhood economist, the show where you'll hear what's going on with the economy locally, nationally, and internationally, explained to you in plain English. Promise. This month on your friendly neighborhood economist, we'll hear about the month's news, learn about the economics of community-run radio stations for some reason, and compare and contrast the tax plans of the two major party presidential candidates. That's President Obama and Governor Romney, if you're not paying attention. Also, we'll be asking you to support the station during our fund drive, the open-air fund drive. So, hide your wallets. Your friendly neighborhood economist is in. First, some news. In a story titled State Comptroller Raises Rates for Pension Contributions by Nathan Mayberg in the Register Star on Thursday, September 6th, we learned that municipalities are going to have to start chipping in even more into the employee retirement system next year from 2013-2014 fiscal year. So that starts in the middle of next year. The current rate is 18.9% of salaries to 20.9%. And the police and fire retirement systems will rise from 25.8% to 28.9% of total salaries. Now, so that's an extra 21% on top of salaries for schools, fire departments, police departments. And this is an almost 60% increase from a couple of years ago. Now, why are these rates going up so much, you may ask? Is it because we're just having a lot of retirements? Let me quote from the story itself. Asked for comment, a spokesman for DiNapoli's office, that's the comptroller, referred to a statement by the comptroller in which he said the common retirement fund continues to rebuild from the substantial financial market loss of 2008-2009. So if you've been under a rock, you may have heard that there was a massive financial crisis in the United States a few years ago that precipitated the recession that we're still supposedly recovering from. Now, one of the side effects of that financial crisis is the continuing devastation in pension funds for cities, towns, states throughout the country and around the world, actually. So because those pension funds were supposedly invested wisely by money managers on Wall Street, many of those pension funds lost a lot of value, which means that in order to make up for that, towns and cities have to pitch in even more. So naturally, you're thinking to yourself, the people who caused this through the systemic fraud that they perpetrated in the financial system by creating all these securities based on homes that were overvalued and mortgages that they knew were bad, that would never be repaid. Of course, all those people who were guilty of fraud have been prosecuted, you may be thinking. But of course, the truth is that none of those people were prosecuted. They're, you know, some of them did lose their jobs. Many of them are still making tons of money. And people everywhere else are still paying the bills for that financial catastrophe. In a not unrelated story from the WGXC newsroom on August 22nd, jobless rate in Twin Counties up. The state labor department released local area unemployment rates for July. Columbia County is up 0.7% from a year before, so 7.9% compared to 7.2% in July of 2011. In Greene County, the jobless rate in 2011 was 8.4%, and in July of 2012, it was 9.4%. So yeah, those two items are not unrelated. Last week, the Census Bureau released its annual report on poverty, entitled Income, Poverty, and Health Insurance Coverage in the United States, 2011, in which we learned that median income, household income, fell by 1.7% between 2010 and 2011, after adjusting for inflation. Since 2007, the year that the financial crisis hit, real median household income has fallen by 8.7%. Median, by the way, if I haven't explained this before, is the exact middle of the income distribution. So if you put everybody in a row, based on lowest to highest income, the person right in the middle is the median, not the average, but the median. So that's fallen by 8.7% in the 4 years between 2007 and 2011. As far as poverty is concerned, it wasn't significantly different in 2011 than in 2010. 12% of families living in poverty, 22% of children in the U.S. live in those families. That's 16 million children living in poverty in the U.S. Since WGXC is having its open air fund drive as this show is airing, spoilers, I'm recording this minutes ahead of time. I got to thinking about the economics of community supported radio stations and nonprofits in general, but I'll just be talking about WGXC today. If you take the assumptions of mainstream economics at face value, this station shouldn't exist, and I'll explain why that is in a bit. But the fact that it does says a lot about the assumptions of mainstream economic theory, but also about human nature. The thing in a nutshell is this. Nobody in our listening area has to pay a dime to listen to this or any of our other amazing shows, and yet they do. Why, you may ask, does this puzzle economists so? Glad you asked. The part of mainstream economic theory that deals with individual actions like buying peanuts or selling your car, called microeconomics, is built on some simplifying assumptions about human behavior. Very simplifying. The idea is that humans are rational actors. They do things in the economic realm, by which I just mean providing for their wants and desires, to further their own interests, regardless of the actions of others. So what we do is determined by our rational calculations about what will bring us the greatest welfare. So given a choice of whether or not to donate money to WGXC or some other worthy cause, we supposedly do so if that will increase our well-being. Of course, we can listen to WGXC whether we give money or not. So why would anybody give? There's a branch of microeconomics theory that deals with this and similar sorts of real-life deviations from the theoretical assumptions. This branch is called institutionalism because it examines the institutions that real-life human societies, like ours, create to solve these sorts of problems. Some of those institutions are what we call government. We have laws and police to enforce them in order to have viable businesses. You wouldn't open a business if anyone could just come and take what you're trying to sell, would you? I'm sure you can think of other examples, but some that I think of are national defense, building roads and bridges, things like that. Of course, you can throw in education and other things as well, and, you know, there's a lot of fiery political rhetoric these days about just what sorts of things should and should not fall into this category. And here in the U.S., we've made our own decisions about that are different from the decisions made in other countries. Now, in the realm of radio, the example is National Public Radio, which is okay for what it does. It covers national and international news, with some local stories occasionally thrown in for color. People talk a lot about how well NPR does at those things, but that's a story for another day. One thing NPR will never do is what a station like WGXC does, which is offer a diversity of programs put together by local people and good coverage of local news. Commercial radio certainly isn't going to do that because it's not profitable. So in order to have that sort of radio, locally controlled and locally produced, we have to be able to pay for it somehow. That's where the fund drive comes in. That's the institution that we've set up to support community radio in our community. Community support is what we rely on for over half the budget to run this station. And because we get community support, the community has its own radio station. What we've done is solve the collective action problem. That's a situation where each individual has an incentive not to contribute, but if we all did that, then we don't get to have the thing that we want. So yay us, we've solved the problem. And so I just want to thank everybody for contributing and helping to support this radio station, giving me a chance to come on and bore you with my economic stories, and give a lot of other people a chance to come on and tell you their own stories. Okay, so this week more about the competing presidential candidates' economic policy proposals. First up, candidate Mitt Romney. A lot of what I'll be talking about today is from the excellent Tax Policy Center's analysis of the tax provisions of the Romney-Ryan plans, as well as various pieces of legislation the president has submitted. So the overview of the Romney plan is basically he would lower taxes for about 70% of households compared to current law. Now, current law, of course, has the Bush-era tax cuts, the ones passed in 2001 and 2003, expiring next year. So compared to that, Romney's plan would lower taxes for many households. Now, the plan unfortunately leaves out an important detail. Now, of course, Mr. Romney talks a lot about fiscal responsibility, and so he claims his plan will reduce the deficit. But the tax cut that he's proposing would add about $900 billion to the deficit, which is about $3,000 for every resident of the United States. Now, the plan says that unspecified measures to broaden the tax base would make up the difference. So, in other words, what does that mean, broaden the tax base? That means if you're going to lower tax rates and at the same time reduce the deficit, you have to somehow increase the amount of income to which those lower tax rates apply. Of course, the question is how, but candidate Romney is not saying. He won't say what the specific proposals are, the specific ways he would increase the tax base, what extra income he would bring into the taxable fold, as it were. You know, some of the big ticket items are the home mortgage interest tax credit, the home, the property tax credit, things like that. So, and earned income tax credits. Of course, there are also corporate tax subsidies, things like that. So what is he going to, remove protections from? That's the question. But no specifics. So there it is. On the other hand, the Obama campaign doesn't have a lot of specifics about tax policy or economic policy in general, as I mentioned last time. However, of course, as the president said in his acceptance speech at the Democratic National Convention last week, he is the president. In other words, we have his budget proposal to look at, as well as the American Jobs Act, which he proposed last year, which didn't have a lot of tax policy in it, but we can ignore that for now. But the budget proposal does have tax implications. The tax provisions in the budget proposal allow the Bush tax cuts to expire for higher income taxpayers, which means that the top tax rate would go back up to 39.6% from 35%. It would also create another tax bracket just below the top rate, which I'll talk about in a bit. Reverting the top rate in this way is projected to reduce the deficit by $849 billion, which is about $27,000 per U.S. resident. $2,700 per U.S. resident. The next largest item in terms of reducing the deficit, anyway, is reduction of certain tax expenditures, which sounds a little confusing, so let me try to explain. A tax expenditure is any policy that either credits taxes. So if you get a tax credit, a reduction of your tax burden, many of which are refundable, like the earned income tax credit, right? So if you end up paying less in taxes than the earned income tax credit you get as a result of your income level and other factors that affect it, then you actually get money back, more money back than you paid in during the year. So that's one thing. Another is tax credits and subsidies for corporations, right? So all of these things that reduce the amount of taxes coming in are called tax expenditures. And so there are quite a lot of them. And the budget proposal reduces them somehow. It's a little vague, and I'll try to find out more specifics about it for you. Okay, so how do the two plans compare? Well, let's see. Again, this is from the Tax Policy Center, and if you want links, of course, they're always in my show notes, which are on my Tumblr blog. That's Tumblr, TUMBLR.com, and I'm your friendly neighborhood economist. So more goodness. In this case, there's a table, which I'll link to, that gives the breakdown of the president's and Romney's tax plans for personal income tax rates. So basically, this is the tax tables, you know, the brackets for all taxable income. So personal income, which also, the table also compares the rates to current law and the pre-Bush tax era law. Okay, so there's four columns, and you can see. I'll talk about single taxpayers in all my examples that I'll be using here. But, you know, there are also, you know, if you've ever filed taxes, you know, you can either file as a single person, you can file as head of household, or, you know, married filing jointly, etc. Anyhow, first, some clarification about how tax brackets work. There's a lot of people I've heard, you know, a little confused about how this works. So I wanted to clarify. So the, for example, the lowest tax bracket for a single person is over zero, but not over $8,700. So that's taxable income. So that's your gross income after, and then you subtract out, you know, your personal deduction, any other deductions, any credits, etc. If you have taxable income, you know, up to $8,700, you pay that rate. Currently, it's 10%, and Obama's proposal would leave it at that. It would be lowered to 8% by Romney. So the confusion arises when you make that next dollar, so that $8,701st dollar of taxable income. A lot of people seem to think that if you make a dollar above $8,700, that you would be taxed at the higher rate, which is currently 15%, for all of your taxable income. But that's just not so. You are taxed at the lowest rate for every dollar you make in taxable income up to the top limit of that bracket. Above that, every dollar you make above that, you're taxed at the higher rate. But the higher rate never applies to the first $8,700 that you make as a single person. So just wanted to clear that up. So that's how they work. So the first $8,700 is taxed at 10%. Your taxable income above $8,700 up to $35,350 is taxed at 15%, and so on, right, up the scale. So anyway, the comparison. So while Romney's plan would decrease taxes in all brackets, right, including the lowest, Obama's plan would leave them unchanged from current law, except for the current top bracket. So the current law, right, is the Bush-era tax cuts, so from 2001 to 2003, so lower than they were in 2000. Now, the change that Obama makes is the top bracket. So first of all, he would split up the next to highest tax bracket, which currently goes from $178,650 to $388,350. He'd split that up more or less in half. Well, not quite in half. The new second to highest tax bracket would begin at $208,250 for individuals and $260,300 for married filing jointly, so households. Although they would both end at $388,350, which is the cutoff for the highest tax bracket. So that second to highest tax bracket would have a tax rate of 36%, which many of those people were paying before 2001 without the tax cuts passed in 2001. People making above the $388,000 would also increase up to what they used to pay, or 39.6%. So those two top brackets change. The rest of the lower bracket, the second highest current bracket, 178 to 208,000 roughly, still pay 33% currently and under this proposal. Romney would reduce the rate on the second highest bracket to 26.4% and on the highest bracket to 28%. So that's a pretty big chunk. So that's how the two plans break down in terms of how they'll most likely affect you when you're filing. Not that many of the people listening to the show will be in that top tax bracket, because that's a lot of taxable income to have. Of course, as I said, it's not the whole story, because the Romney plan has, you know, the missing pieces about how he's going to broaden the tax base in order to, you know, make up the money that he's giving back in tax cuts and somehow be revenue neutral, which means not adding to the deficit. So that's a tall order. It's a lot of money, $900 billion, right? That's a quarter of federal revenues currently. So one out of every $4 he's going to cut. He's got to make it up somehow. The question is where. You know, is he going to take it from personal deductions, right? People get to take, individuals get to take $3,800 off the top, right, of their gross income to get to their taxable income. And then there's, you know, the standard deduction, you know, and then exemptions for dependents and all these things. And as I mentioned, mortgage interest deduction, you know, all these deductions are, is that how he's going to do it? We don't know. That seems the most likely place, because that's where a lot of the money is. That's where a lot of the tax expenditures are. You know, there's also that heading under the Obama proposal, tax expenditure reduction. You know, where is he coming up with that? That's a good question. I'd like to know the answer. So hopefully more will be revealed soon. This has been your friendly neighborhood economist. I can be heard on the third Wednesday of every month or anytime online. Check me out on WGXC.org, on Facebook at Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist, on Twitter at capital Y, capital F, capital N, capital E, Economist, or on Tumblr at yfneconomist.tumblr.com. If you've got a question you've been dying to ask a sympathetic economist, send it to me through one of those venues or email me at yfneconomist@gmail.com. Your Friendly Neighborhood Economist is brought to you by WGXC 90.7 FM Hudson Catskill ICRA and produced by Thomas Masterson. That's me. I'll talk to you next month.